So we've learned a bunch of things, and especially we've learned the new formalism that allows us to deal with the states as operators. And that is a very important generalization, but today you will appreciate why this technique is absolutely necessary to do some things. But we already saw a hint. We saw that when we make a measurement, the measurement is a quantum operation, right? Because you start with a state, and at the end of the measurement, you have a state. But measurement is not unitary, because it does not preserve the purity. In other words, you start, even if you start with a pure state, after measurement, you do not have a pure state. So that's why we're kind of forced of using this formalism, which is very important in quantum information. Okay, and today we will see a very, very important example why we have to use this formalism, which is near, close to the heart of our problem. And it is the problem of quantum equilibration and let me put in parentheses, and the thermalization. So, as I said, maybe the first lecture, there is, you know, there are some laws of physics that you really should not mess with. And these are the laws of thermodynamics. And in some way, the laws of thermodynamics were known to mankind since forever, because everyone noticed that, you know, when they have their hot cup of coffee, it's very hot, and you wait a little bit, well, if you don't drink it soon, it becomes cold and it sucks. And when you have your chilled glass of champagne, okay, this is a cocktail because it has ice cubes, it's very chilled, it's very nice. If you wait too long, it becomes bleh, broth. Okay, so, and these people, because people liked, you know, beverages since forever, they knew that. And there is nothing that you can do to prevent that. So when physicists started, you know, doing their laws of mechanics and of quantum mechanics, there was this very unfortunate thing that all these laws are microscopic laws. Are time reversal. But all these processes of equilibration, they are non-time reversal. That's why it's equilibration, right? You start somewhere and you equilibrate and you don't evolve anymore. And so how is this possible? And so the foundations of statistical mechanics basically are concerned with this problem. How can we find the real laws of physics, those that we know they're right, because we see them, in the face of microscopic laws that are time reversal? Well, that's a big puzzle. And we are concerned with this problem in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, this problem is very tough. We have already had a hint about this, that unitary evolution preserves the purity. And thermalization, okay, I'll talk about thermalization in a second. So let's set up the stage. So time evolution, the microscopic time evolution that is unitary, is generated by a Hamiltonian that we write in the spectral resolution in this way, where of course these projectors are the projectors onto the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And as you can see, the way I wrote this Hamiltonian, whereas, you know, showing that these projectors are all one dimensional, it means that it's non-degenerate, right? That you do not have two eigenvalues that are the same for different states. Okay, so this non-degenerate. So I'm doing this assumption, right? And I would like to discuss with you guys, what do you think of this assumption before we go ahead? So who of you think that this is a very strong assumption that we're making? And who of you thinks that this assumption is okay, it's not very strong? Yes, please speak up. Yeah, you can unmute yourself. You can talk.
I reckon it's pretty strong.
You think it's very strong? Okay, can you argue about that?
Well, a lot of systems that we see have degeneracy, right? Almost all systems that we see, a particle in a box, a hydrogen atom, things that are of particular physical interest seem to all have degeneracy.
Okay, so I like this. I like this way of looking at it. So your colleague is saying a lot of the systems that you are interested in have degeneracy. Okay. So what happens if you take your Hamiltonian that has a degeneracy? So first of all, why does a Hamiltonian have a degeneracy? What does the degeneracy correspond to physically? Why, how does it happen that some physical system that is described with a Hamiltonian would have degenerate energies? What do you think is underlying this property that some systems have?
I think it's, for example, particles that can have the same energy eigenvalue, so the same energy level, but for example have different spins, and then they are degenerate.
Yeah, so the question somehow is why this happens, that to different states correspond the same energies. Does any of you have a physical sense of that? I can give you a hint. Are you familiar with this thing called Noether theorem?
Yes. Somehow.
Okay.
We just talked about it in symmetries class.
Yeah. So a degeneracy means that in the Hamiltonian means that if you do the time evolution, some quantity is conserved, right? So imagine you have some operator that has a support only in a degenerate subspace of the Hamiltonian. Do you understand what I mean when I say that an operator has a support, or do you want me to define this?
I don't know that. Could you define it, please?
Yeah. So you remember when I said that sometimes that operators, like an operator A, could have a part that actually acts on the subsystem A. So let me actually do it better. So what I mean is that some operator, so forget about the tensor product, is zero everywhere, but in some block is non-zero. Okay, so it only couples states within that block. So now imagine you have an operator that has this property. This means that as my state phi of t evolves, when I compute the expectation value of A, in phi of t, it will only see what's going on in here. You know, all the components of phi of t on other states will not count. Now, imagine that you prepare your system, your phi of t, so imagine that your Hamiltonian has a degeneracy for these states. Now this quantity would be conserved in time. So this is a manifestation on Noether's theorem. So degeneracies correspond to a symmetry. There is also another way of seeing that degeneracy corresponds to a symmetry. What happens if you perturb your Hamiltonian? Okay, so you have your Hamiltonian. Let me diagonalize it. Okay, so you have this eigenvalue, this eigenvalue, this eigenvalue. And now these two eigenvalues here are the same. So we have a degeneracy. So this is H0. And now I sum to this operator a small perturbation V. What happens to these two eigenvalues? So you have done perturbation theory, right?
Yeah, they tend to separate.
They split, right? They split, there is splitting, unless...
Unless the perturbation has the same degeneracy.
Has the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So if there is a degeneracy, it means that there is some operator such that this is zero, right? That's a symmetry. Of course, this operator must exist, right? If there is a degeneracy, because this is the operator that sends this state in this state. If this operator would not commute with the Hamiltonian, they could not have the same eigenvalues. So if V has the same symmetry, then it's not split. Okay, now the request for some operator V having the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian, exactly the same symmetry, right? If this does not, you know, it does not exactly commute with that symmetry, then there is a splitting. Do you think this is strong or weak requirement? So is it easy to split or it's harder to split as a degeneracy?
It's easier to split.
Yeah.
Please say again, because
the perturbation I'd have to have the same symmetry for it to not split. So it'd probably be easier for it to split.
Yeah, it's very easy to split a degeneracy. So imagine you take a random operator. Do you think that by chance it will have the same symmetry? No, symmetry is something fine-tuned. It's fine-tuned. So if it is fine-tuned, it's rare. So symmetries are rare. You must have exactly the Hamiltonian. So in the space of all these Hermitian operators, operators that have a symmetry are very rare, are actually, one can prove it, a set of measure zero. So the degeneracies are actually very rare. So, you know, you can handpick a system that has the degeneracy, But unless it's that Hamiltonian, and in an experimental situation, it's never exactly that Hamiltonian, because there are stray magnetic fields, weird couplings, and stuff like that. You never really see an exact degeneracy. Unless this symmetry is a fundamental symmetry. Okay? So a fundamental symmetry are, you know, like parity or superselection sectors, like, you know, baryonic number is conserved, these kind of things. So those are protected by some law nature that, you know, prevents this thing from being, okay, I have to plug this thing. Sorry about this. Okay. Okay, so our point is that requesting that this is non-degenerate is actually not strong at all. Almost all Hamiltonians are non-degenerate. The fact that you can handpick one that is degenerate, of course you can. You can handpick somebody who's won the lottery, but it's really like the lottery. Actually, it's at the measure zero. Very good. Same thing goes for another form of degeneracy that is what is called the degenerate gaps. What do I mean by this? I mean that imagine you have these two levels in the Hamiltonian that have some gap, delta one, and then there are some two other levels that, and then have a bunch of other levels. So as you can see, this is non-degenerate, this Hamiltonian. But if this gap is also delta one, now we have degenerate gaps. Now I'm asking you the same question in view of what we said. Do you think that having degenerate gaps is typical or not? It's very untypical. So from now on, we will be concerned with realistic Hamiltonians. Realistic Hamiltonians do not have degeneracies and they do not have degenerate gaps. Okay? Many of the things that I will say can be extended to Hamiltonians that have some degeneracies, but it just makes the whole discussion much more complicated. And it doesn't matter anyway because the degeneracies are not robust. Okay, so we were saying we have a non-degenerate Hamiltonian. And this induces time evolution in this way. So a state will evolve in this way, which is defined in this way. And operators will evolve in this way, which is just the other way around with respect to the states. Okay. And expectation values that I will just call AT without the hat. Now, in this notation, I can be sometimes sloppy. So I will sometimes call AT also the operators. But in the context should usually make it clear whether I'm talking about the expectation value or the operator. Right now I'm talking of the expectation value. So, you know, if I should not put the hat because it's a number and this is equal to the trace of A as an operator phi t, or, which is the same, the trace of the A hat operator in the initial state phi. And you know, you call this thing the Schrödinger picture and this thing the Heisenberg picture. And they're obviously the same because of the properties of the trace. Okay.
why are the evolutions reversed for the operator and the state? Like, why do I have the minus?
Because nature decided that way. So these are the solutions of the Schrödinger equation.
Okay.
And we didn't get to choose which equation describes nature. So if you want, it's experimental. It's experimental in a very abstract sense, but we know it from experience. So these are the formulae that accommodate the experience that we found. So, what I mean is that you can take these things as definitions. Okay? If you take them as a definition and then you postulate that this is the expectation value, then this is an identity that is a theorem, right? Because it's the property of the trace. And now all you need to show is that these expectation values are those that you really find in nature. And and they are because this is nothing else, but the, we already did this thing. We said, oh, this is, the just the sum of the probabilities of being in a certain state times the expectation value of that operator in that state. So this is nothing but the Schrödinger picture that you already know. So if we define this evolution to be this way, then we know we can compute expectations values also in this way. And they're all consistent with the experiments.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So we also have this third possibility of taking trace of A hat T with phi T. And so this is all, like, entirely on the basis of observations. We are ignoring that possibility, right?
Yeah. So if you take the trace.
Yeah, that would not give any.
So this is what you're asking. What is the meaning of this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you should try to do this as an exercise.
That would just give a hat phi, right? Yeah, sorry.
It would just give us the initial value, right?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay, great. Okay, so what is equilibration? Equilibration means that we have some initial state, then this evolves in time with ut, it becomes phi t, and then eventually, at some time t star, it gets to some equilibration, right? And after that, it doesn't evolve anymore. So if I evolve this, I would get again this. This is called mathematically a fixed point. And because, this family of unitaries is continuous, you can also immediately see that also this is equal if equilibration happens. I can keep evolving forever, nothing will happen. So this phi hat is what is called a steady state. A state that is a fixed point of our unitary operator, right? Means this means a steady state. Now, let's try to understand. What do you think steady states can be? Can you give me an example of a state that will not evolve? Because equilibrium states can only be steady states, right?
The inertia could be an example.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
The inertia, when an object is in the same state forever and ever in motion.
No, well, so, you know, here we're in the context of quantum mechanics, and I'm asking what properties should phi have such that this is true? How do we characterize that?
Eigenvectors would do, yeah.
Hmm?
Eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian.
An eigenstate, you said?
Yeah.
Very good. So if phi is an eigenstate, so you're saying it's pure in this case, right? If phi is some of these eigenstates, then you know that it will not evolve, right? Okay, this is just a phase that means nothing. Right? So eigenstates definitely are steady states. Now the question, are eigenstates the only steady states of the Hamiltonian? Can you give me one example of a state that is not an eigenstate, but it's a steady state? Any idea? Okay, so what about a state that, for instance, example, the Gibbs state. Is this going to be a steady state or not? So one way of checking is to take the time derivative, right? We want this to be zero. And the time derivative of a state, you know, you just take literally the time derivative of this, right? So just do this exercise. Remember what this means. This means, I don't know if you've ever done this exercise in ordinary quantum mechanics, but you will have probably found that this is equal to this, which is the so-called Heisenberg equation. But you know, you just take this derivative and you will find this. And now you see that this is zero if and only if the commute. So these are the steady states, are the states that commute to the Hamiltonian. Exercise, these are additional exercises that have to do just with, you know, linear algebra, basically understanding what operators are. If f is a function of an operator, any function of an operator, like this, right? This is a function of an operator. Then they come here. So now we know what the steady states are. Are all those states that are the functions of the Hamiltonian, so the eigenstates, any combination, any convex combination of the eigenstates.
Do you have one more example of a function or of a state that would commute with the Hamiltonian? Or can you also explain the Gibbs state, what it is?
Okay, so this one. With P1 plus P2 equal 1. Try that and see that it does commute with Hamiltonian. And then you can generalize, right? What is the Gibbs state? The Gibbs state is this thing. So Z is just the trace of beta H. So it's a number. Okay, so let me, you take this trace, it's a number. So is, let me write this object in the basis in which the Hamiltonian is diagonal, right? That's the convenient basis. This one. This is what the Gibbs state is. It's just telling us the probability of having this energy is the probability of being in this state and having energy n is the Boltzmann probability. So every state that commutes with Hamiltonian means that it's diagonal in the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. So it has always this form. So these are the steady states. Okay. So they're just a distribution probability over the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. It could be an extremal distribution probability, so it's an eigenstate. Or it could be the Boltzmann distribution probability, and then it's the Gibbs state, or it could be another distribution probability over the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So morally, your colleague that said, oh, it should be an eigenstate was kind of there, but you don't need to be just an eigenstate. It can be any convex combination of eigenstates, or in other words, a probability distribution over the eigenstates. So you see, this is another reason why we need mixed states. Mixed states describe all the states that are steady. So, and now we want to show, we want to answer this question, is equilibration possible? Is it possible? And the answer is no. It's not possible. Why? I will prove it in a second. Because time reversal. Or in other words, imagine you have a pure state, pure. So the purity is one. Then it equilibrates, let's say equilibrates to the Gibbs state. Is this state pure or not?
No.
It's not pure, right? Because it's a Boltzmann's distribution probability. It's not 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. It's not extremal. And as you know, this is not possible. Okay, then you could argue, okay, maybe something else can go on. Maybe I equilibrate to a state that has the same purity. Okay, maybe it's just because you started with a pure state. So okay, can we have something more rigorous? Okay, let me give you something more rigorous. Okay, so imagine that we have an equilibrium state, which means that we want it to be non-trivial, right? Non-trivial means that is not the initial state. Of course, if I start in an equilibrium state, then I stay there. That's okay. That's possible, of course. But I want equilibration means that I have this state, it evolves, and then eventually becomes an equilibrium state. I want to show that this is not possible. So let's show it. So imagine we have an equilibrium state, then this means that if I take the distance, oh, this is a distance, by the way. So you take these two operators, you make the difference, and then you take the norm. As you know, in every Banach space, which is a fancy way of saying any decent space, a norm induces a topology, which means a distance, right? So this is a distance. We will say more things about distances later, but so this must be zero, right? If this happens. Eventually phi of t will become phi equilibrium, and so this limit should be zero. Okay, so now let's just use our definitions. What is phi of t? Is this. And phi equilibrium must be a fixed point. So I can write it in this way. And now u is linear, right? It's a linear operator. And it's norm preserving. Remember, we proved that. And it's norm preserving means that this is just the norm of phi minus phi ak. And these two operators now do not depend on time. So the limit is the same at every time because they do not depend on time. And so you see, if this is zero, this is zero, which means that phi was from the beginning, the equilibrium state. So either you start from a steady state and you stay there, but if a state is not an equilibrium state, it will never equilibrate. If you start away from equilibrium, it will never reach the equilibrium. So equilibration is impossible. So this is the rigorous, although very simple, proof that equilibration in quantum mechanics is impossible. However, it does happen, right? It does happen. We see it all the time. That happened to my cup of coffee this morning because I forgot it on the counter. And then I was preparing the problems for today. So definitely something is fishy here. So how do we get out of this? Any idea?
Perhaps the time evolution should not be unitary.
Very good. Okay, so this is a possible solution. Well, so let's say, when you say the time evolution should not be unitary, you may be saying one of these two things. Are you saying that quantum mechanics is wrong? That's one possibility. Right? Because quantum mechanics says, given a system that is ruled by Hamiltonian H, time evolution is U of t defined the way we define, and this is unitary. So this is a postulate. So are you denying this thing, which means, okay, we need to improve quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics obviously is not doing the right job. Or you're saying something else. Which of the two, did I understand correctly that this is what you mean?
No, I think I mean something like perhaps there's some random perturbation or random noise that we should take into account, or perhaps the Hamiltonian itself should be time dependent, although I think that leaves you unitary now that I think about it.
Yes, even if it's time dependent, and even if it's a random operator, no matter what you do to the Hamiltonian, is still a unitary evolution. And as you can see, our previous proof is about unitary evolutions. So, of course, this cannot be thought. This is a sin. So, quantum mechanics is right. So, there must be something else. One possibility is that when I'm looking at my cup of coffee and I'm using my Hamiltonian for the cup of coffee, I'm forgetting that this is in some environment, which is the kitchen, that it has its own Hamiltonian. So this is Hamiltonian of the cup, this is Hamiltonian of the kitchen. And plus, they are interacting, so there is an Hamiltonian of interaction. And I should take in account, so the, you see, if I only look at the cup of coffee, only ruled by this, I'm forgetting this. So I have the Hamiltonian of the full system is the cup of coffee plus the kitchen plus the interaction. Let me call it the CK. Now, this is the full Hamiltonian. So let's play this game. So I have my initial state, psi, that I can say, think of, okay, let's say is my cup of coffee at the beginning.
I have a question. So what you're saying is that we will never reach the equilibrium if we don't take account the
environment.
System, the environment is what you're
saying. No, all I'm saying is that if the evolution is unitary, theorem, you cannot reach equilibrium and evolution is unitary. So, but now let's look at the evolution for just the cup of coffee. Okay, so let's say that initially we have our state that is a state of the cup and the kitchen together as a simple form because I just prepared my cup of coffee, it's hot. And now I have my kitchen, which is in whatever state the kitchen is. I don't know what it is. And now I have my Hamiltonian, that is this one, the one that we said before, right? And this will generate some U. So at the time T, the total state is gonna be UT, my initial state. So far so good. But if I only look at the cup of coffee, I have to trace out the kitchen. This is the state at the time t of my cup of coffee, right? So I have to trace out this thing. Now, is it possible that UOT, so is this state in this bipartition, is this state entangled or not? It's not, it's a tensor, it's a product state. But after I operate with this unitary operation on this state, is it can be entangled or not? Can, right? You can entangle you. And if I trace out the kitchen, sorry, I forgot the K here, now I get something that is impure, which means that this evolution, the evolution of just the cup of coffee, is not unitary.
pardon me. On the previous slide, was that a superscript dagger or a superscript T?
T.
Okay. And why should we trace out the kitchen?
Because the state of the cup of coffee is the total state when you trace out whatever is not the cup of coffee. And you remember, that's why we made that problem a couple of days ago, that was, oh, imagine that I have a Hilbert space that is made of two parts, and I'm measuring something only on the cup of coffee. I only observe the cup of coffee. I called it tilde. And I want the expectation value of this observable in my total state. Or we know this was the exercise. This is an identity. This is equal to measuring A in what I called psi A. And what is psi A? Trace out the kitchen.
Right, yes, I'm remembering.
Okay, so that's the operational meaning of that.
Excuse me.
So this thing is called the theory of open quantum systems. Yep, go ahead.
So we have the Hamiltonian of the cup, which can act on the state of the cup. And we have the Hamiltonian of the kitchen, which can act on the state of the kitchen. So we can't actually take some of them, right? It doesn't make sense.
So if you only have those two Hamiltonians, then you're saying they're not interacting. And if they're not interacting, then it means that a cup of coffee, you can just look at the evolution of the cup of coffee on its own, because it's not interacting with anything else, and that will be unitary, and the cup of coffee will not equilibrate.
No, I just have this. We wrote the complete Hamiltonian as HC plus H, H of interaction plus H of kitchen.
Ah, okay. So if you have.
So how? What does this? How do we exactly operate on a? There are two systems here. So there's a tensor product. So our H should be something defined on one system and something defined on the other system.
No. So not every operator. So this operator, that's a great question. Is this operator, right?
Okay, that's the point of separability, right?
Yes, very good, very good. Okay. This does not have the form an operator on A, sorry, on the cup of coffee tensor, an operator on the kitchen. Does not have that form. But it would have that form if this is not there. Because then they would commute these things. And if they commute, you can write this in this way. Or now this is an operator on just the cup and this is an operator on just the kitchen. But the interaction makes all these operators do not commute. Unless it's a very, very special interaction, right? But typically not.
Yes.
So at the end, the only way we don't have the unitary evolution is if we have these two systems entangled and we traced out one of the systems.
Correct. That's the only way of not having a unitary evolution, the only way that is not a sin. Okay. Now, at the beginning of the last century, there was this, let me tell you this story. Who of you has heard about, I thought I would cover one half of what I prepared, I covered one fourth of what I prepared. Okay, but let me tell you this story because it's a lot of fun. Who of you knows William James? William James was an American philosopher whose home I can see from here. It's over there in Cambridge. And and one of the founders of a current called pragmatism. But at any rate, he was giving, this was, you know, at the end, I think, of 19th century, or actually. Yeah. Or the very beginning of the century, of the 20th century. Anyway, he was giving a talk about cosmology. Well, whatever they knew of cosmology at the time, you know, was describing the position of Earth in the solar system, the solar system in the universe. They started thinking about galaxies and stuff like that. And there was an old lady in the audience said, oh, Professor James, I really don't agree with you. And the reason is that, you know, we all know that Earth, you know, I studied Hindu philosophy. This is what she said. And she thought she studied Hindu philosophy. And she said, you know, according to some of the legends, Earth is resting on the back of a giant elephant. And this giant elephant is resting on the back of a gymongous tortoise. And William James said, oh, okay, dear lady, but I mean, this is not really working, because where does the tortoise rest upon? And she said, oh, there's a larger tortoise. And then we just said, all right, but then what about this one tortoise? And she said, oh, you don't understand. It's tortoises all the way down forever. And of course we smile to this, you know, to, you know, we say, all right, yeah, it's fun. Okay. I mean, it's funny in for us, not for the people out there, but for us it's fun. Now let's think of the way we think of thermalization. We say, okay, the cup of coffee actually will thermalize because we have an environment that is in the Gibbs state at a fixed temperature. So it's an environment that has thermalized. And we say, oh, how did this thermalize? Oh, because my kitchen is in a larger environment that is called Cambridge. The task thermalized. Oh, why did Cambridge thermalize? Oh, because it's in Massachusetts, the task thermalized. All the way down. For the whole universe. Now you have the whole universe. There's nothing out. Why task thermalized? And if the whole universe had thermalized, then we were back to square one. There is no equilibration, there is no life, there is nothing happening. We have already thermalized. The oil is the Gibbs state. So, you know, we can laugh at that old lady, but right now, you know, the orthodoxy about quantum thermalization is tortoises all the way down. So now you can see that you should rebel to this. Okay? We should be enraged. This not, you know, we cannot tolerate this. So we need some other kind of solution. So we need a way of not making any sin, saying, okay, this is unitary, because we really don't like to sin. But also we don't want to say ridiculous things. We must be in a closed system. So we should not evoke tortoises out there. So what is the way out? Any suggestion? So this is a theorem. Tt will not equilibrate. Do you have any idea, any suggestion, something that can get us unstuck?
Well, I have an idea that that not only the phi of t will not equilibrate, it's just that also the system depends on the cup of coffee. I mean, that the cup of coffee thermalized because of the system of the kitchen, and the kitchen thermalized because of the system of the coffee.
This is a very important remark. The theory of open quantum systems requires very strong assumptions on the environment, because in principle also the environment could be disturbed by the cup of coffee. You're absolutely right. But right now we are doing away with the environment altogether, because the environment is a tortoise. So we have just the cup of coffee, and we want just the cup of coffee to equilibrate. However, we have this theorem that phi of t will not equilibrate. And I want to know from you guys an idea to get out of this paradox. Because, you know, I'm maintaining two things. One is that things equilibrate, because it's true. I experimented it this morning. And the other one is that quantum mechanics is right. So what are we missing?
So you are looking, you want us to come up with a new answer, right? Because we already said that the interaction of the kitchen and the cup, this is the tortoise thing.
Yeah.
The All right. paradox.
Mm-hmm. I want an idea.
I don't have an idea, but I do have a question.
Yep.
When we require interaction between the coffee and the environment, was the assumption that the environment had already thermalized?
Correct.
Is that a necessary assumption?
Yes.
Okay.
Otherwise, you cannot prove thermalization even in presence of interactions, at least in the usual theory of open quantum system. There are a lot of assumptions that one makes. Some of them are strong, some are less strong. But we'd always require that the environment has thermalized. The other thing that we require is what your colleague raised. That was an incredible comment. We require that the environment doesn't care what the cup of coffee does. It stays thermalized no matter what. With cup of coffee is kind of true, but if instead of a cup of coffee, I have a bowl of trinitrotoluene, then it's not true anymore. If that explodes, the temperature of my kitchen will change. So it's not always true.
Can we look at the cup of coffee as a superposition of different states? So that the cup of coffee is not described by one state, but...
Yeah. When I say that this is the state of the cup of coffee, this is the initial state. Mm-hmm. This is a generic state.
Yeah.
In some basis. So it's both a superposition or a mixed state that also has coherence. Is this, it's the most generic state that you can imagine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, the reason why you don't see a way out is because you have been taught quantum mechanics with a prejudice. The prejudice is that phi is a thing. And phi is not a thing. That nothing happens to phi. Things happen when they happen. Remember, phi is describing the possibilities. What happens is expectation values of observables. This is what you see. This is a happening. So you should not think of, oh, can this equilibrate? You should think of, can this equilibrate? You never see phi. Phi is part of the theoretical nucleus, and it's part of the theoretical nucleus in a specific way that phi can never be seen. Because wave functions do not happen. They are part of the theory that determines what can happen to observables. So you always have to think of observables. That's the contact with experience. Remember, physics is an experimental science in spite of all this operator stuff. Okay, now, so the next question is, can this value equilibrate? But so you see, we made some progress, right? We made some progress. So unfortunately, there is a theorem due to von Neumann that says A of t is quasi-periodic. So, and if a function is quasi-periodic, then you know that this limit does not exist. So again, even the expectation values never cease evolving.
But is there not a similar theorem in classical mechanics?
There is a similar theorem in classical mechanics, that's correct. In fact, some of these problems are true also classical mechanics, because in general, we have a problem. How do we show thermalization in the face of microscopic equations of the motion? And the reason why we are discussing this problem in the context of quantum mechanics is because quantum mechanics is a more fundamental theory.
Classical but in some mechanics. Sense, at least, we've moved away from the problems that are specific to quantum, right?
Yes and no. We have a similar problem for similar reasons, but they're not exactly the same reasons. And now the devil is in the details. So let's start with quantum mechanics. Sorry, let's stick with quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, the problem is at the same time harder because unitary evolution is something very strong, but clearer. Classical mechanics is slightly messier. Quantum mechanics is very clean. Okay. So let's sketch a possible solution. So let me show you something that is quasi-periodic. Okay, something like this. The sign is periodic, so it's also quasi-periodic, right? So, yeah, there is no conceivable sense in which I can imagine that, so this is A of t, it's a function of t. There is no conceivable sense in which this is some kind of thermalizing thing. But what about this? Imagine something like this. And then much later, I get back to the initial value. So you see, this is quasi-periodic, right? But every time I observe these values, so there is an initial period of time in which, okay, I am evolving in time. And now, almost always, I am within a very tiny band of possible values. And then I start over again. So almost always, I am very close to this value. Well, this is good enough. This, maybe this is what we observe. What you observe is that the probability that the value of A at the time t is different from the sum value, let me call that red value, let me call it my wannabe equilibrium value. The probability that this is greater than some number epsilon, this is super small. So this is compatible with the quasi-periodic function. And it's compatible with what we observe. This is called equilibration probability. Or in other words, more plain English words, A of T has typical values. Means as long as I don't observe it at the beginning, then has a typical value that is very close to some AEQ. Before I go ahead, I would like to take some questions because I want all of this to be very, very, very clear. And in fact, I have discussed, I thought 1/8 of the material is indeed 1/8, 1/4 of the material is 1/8 of the material. But makes sense what I'm saying? So you have a bunch of problems that you should not do now because we didn't get that. So the only problem that I think of those that I gave that you can look at. So let me indeed check if this is the case. How do I close this? Let me see. Let me look at the problems. Okay, yeah, let's talk about problems 1.1, 1.2, and that's it. 1.1 and 1.2. So open your handout, and we start doing this together, and then I will leave you to discuss them a bit. Okay, I don't, where are you guys? Oh my God, this thing is, all right, you're here, okay. So let's start slowly, okay? So first of all, let's try to understand what is this equilibrium value? This wannabe equilibrium value, right? So we are imagining that this thing can happen. So there is some equilibrium value here. Which is some value close to which our real A of T typically is. I would like to know what value is it? Do we have an idea on about how to compute that? But let's just look at this plot, at this figure.
Well, I guess that at some point we have some maximums and minimums which gave us a rank that could be that epsilon in which the AT can be.
Yeah. That's indeed a very important way of thinking. You're trying to think whatever is that value, I actually would like to know not only what is the value, the red value, but I also want to know, you know, what is this band, right? These are what one would call the fluctuations. Indeed, if the fluctuations are large, then there is no point. Right? And that, so that's really the important thing, but we're starting, so that's a bit harder to find the fluctuations. I want to start with something, you know, easier, regardless of the fluctuations. Maybe they're large, but what is this value in the middle, the red value? So do you agree that the only possibility for this red value is to be the time average? It's the average value in there, right? The one in the middle of the fluctuations. So it is this object over very large time. And remember, we computed something similar the other day. We computed this. And now it's a simple exercise that you can do as we, you know, conclude this meeting to show that this object here is nothing else but the trace of just the original operator in phi bar. So the typical value depends on phi bar. So now one thing that we would like to say, even before saying, oh, the fluctuations are very small, is this. Because imagine that, you see, I sketched this image in which after super long time, I go back to the initial set because I have to go back to the initial value. But I would like this probability of being back to the initial value to be very small. Otherwise, I'm screwed. So let's try to compute this. Let's try to compute what is the probability of getting to the initial value. And this definitely depends on the probability of phi of t going back to phi, to the initial state. What is this probability? It's just this overlap, right? It's the density of probability that at the time t, phi of t will be equal to phi. And I want to know, on average, what is this probability? So I have to take the bar. So this is your problem. So this quantity, this return probability, is called the Loschmidt-Echo, calligraphic LT, and then we're taking the time average of this Loschmidt-Echo. And there are a couple of problems in your problem one that have to do with this quantity. So basically problem 1-1 and problem 1-2. And this is what we guys are gonna do now. So maybe this is a good time to break in break rooms.